Hello, bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 105 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is the year 2025, the year of the snake, and this time I am joined by one of my co-hosts, Carmen Leskovienski. How's it going, Carmen?
That's a long story, but the short answer is fine.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about how you were feeling earlier, but we don't have to go into that. You're doing good.
I'm ill, but I am here.
Yeah. Yep. We're glad that I can have you here today to help me talk to a very special guest on our show today. And also, you're a curator. So we got a fellow curator on the show. I think this is really cool. Mm-hmm. We have Aaron Packard of the Pacific Bonsai Museum. How's it going? Yeah.
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me on. Well, we were able to coordinate this despite my lack of awareness on time zones and scheduling and stuff. So thanks for being flexible on that end.
It's totally fine.
No worries.
Because before this, let me see. Let's make sure. Yep. Before this, Carmen was actually over at Michael's in Portland. So we had the same issues all the time. So don't worry.
Different
time zones still confuse me. I mean, Carmen and Mike are an hour ahead of me, and I still can't wrap my head around it.
I still get confused now that I'm an hour ahead of you instead of 2 hours behind you.
It's still
very messed up.
So awkward. But anyway, we're going to be talking to Aaron about curatorship, his background, projects that they do at the museum. They do some really cool exhibits there, and we could talk about that, how they plan that out and everything, and talk about some of the trees that are at the museum. If the listeners are aware, that I'm a huge fan of the Pacific Bonsai Museum. I talk about it a lot. It comes up in a lot of our previous episodes. If you guys have tracked, I talk about you guys a good bit. And it's just because some of the trees there are just some of my favorites. So we'll go into that, and I'll ask you some questions about that too as we go. But before we get into that, I do need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons over at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. You can go over there and become a bonsai best bud and hang out in the Discord and talk with all these great bonsai people about bonsai nonstop. Bonsai. I don't know if we announced our newest specimen best bud, our $30 member, Tolbert. So we got a new specimen best bud. Thank you so much for sponsoring us at that level. It's amazing. Every little bit counts towards helping us pay Matt. Matt gets really angry when we don't pay him. Editors are not cheap. I'm just kidding, Matt. He's a sweetheart. But thank you guys so much for keeping the little things going so we can print more shirts and pay Matt, like I said, and also put together our little things scholarship we do at the end of every year. So you guys are awesome. And of course, we got our main show sponsors, Joshua Roth Tools, Underhill Bonsai, you're welcome, and the Bonsai Bar. I forgot to mention them earlier.
Bonsai Bar.
Yep. And then our other specimen best buds, Unryuin in Australia with Rick, Bill Butler's Bill's Bayou, and Mark McWilliams. Sorry, I want it to be McMillan's for some reason. And of course, J. David Tolbert. And thank you again, Joshua Tools, for sponsoring. I think I said that a little bit earlier. Yep. My notes need to be reorganized. And then, of course, can't go much further without mentioning Matt O'Donnell. You can go over to mattodonnell.com to fill out your contact form to contact him if you want to start your own podcast show about anything. He's open to starting podcast shows and editing with people and doing whatever people are into. So he's looking to expand his horizons on that. So go over to mattodonnell.com and drop him a line or something. I don't know. Whatever people say nowadays, I don't know if I'm not cool anymore. So, but yeah, he's an all around awesome guy. It's in the script to say it every single time. Love you, Matt. Okay. So Aaron, I asked you a little bit earlier before we jumped on, but, tell us about what you did today. I told you you had to repeat it, but, go ahead.
Yeah. One of the things I love about bonsai curatorship and maybe bonsai in general is every day is different. You're not doing the same thing, from day to day. So, today's Thursday, which is our one of our volunteer days. So we have a awesome core group of volunteers that come out Thursdays and Fridays and help me take care of the bonsai collection. And so it's usually a matter of just, you know, preparing work for them, making sure we're getting the right tree to the right person based on their skill set and interest and familiarity with bonsai, and then working with them throughout the day And, you know, if you've been to a bonsai workshop or I'm sure Carmen can speak to that, you know, it's a lot of fun conversation and banter and working on trees, which is kind of why I do what I do. So don't always get to work on the trees as much as I want, but Thursdays are the day I can definitely, you know, say I'm busy. I'm working on trees today. I'm working with the volunteers. So that was the first half. And then kind of speaking to exhibitions, we received our exhibition materials, the printed from our printer, which is always kind of a roll of the dice. You know, we never know if everything's going to come out great the first time. Sometimes you've got to send things back because it's been misprinted or it's been slightly scratched in transit or whatever. You know, there's a quality control that we have to perform. So we are a week less. Well, I'm in starting to install a new exhibition on Monday. So in like four or five days. New exhibitions coming out. So it's another busy time in addition to the trees. All of the exhibition planning is culminating into installation week, which from my curatorial exhibition design background is like repotting season. You know, it's super exciting, super fun, a lot of work, but you've sort of been working or planning towards that for months, if not year plus. To make that happen. So yeah, a lot, you know, a lot's going on, and then checking the trees, making sure we're, you know, they're happy. So it's, you know, a lot going on at a public bonsai museum for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We talk a good bit about curatorship and, what Carmen's responsibilities are at, sorry, you can say it, Carmen. I don't want to mispronounce the garden name.
Oh, Mathai Botanical Gardens. Yeah.
So we get a lot of good conversation about, you know, taking care of and maintaining a public collection like that. And then I come from the side of growing and working trees and, you know, selling trees and stuff at a bonsai nursery. So it's a little bit of a dynamic there. But yeah, getting to know another curator, though, because that's something that me and Carmen have discussed in the past. It's like more people should take up the mantle of being curators because those old trees are important, and there's got to be people who have to, you know, steward those trees into the future, basically. And that's really cool. So if you don't mind, can we get your like personal background, or is that too much?
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm happy to share that. Yeah. It's kind of hard to know where to begin exactly. Try not to give you maybe the Cliff Notes version, but more or less, I grew up in Southern California. Both my parents were avid gardeners. My dad had a small bonsai collection growing up, so they were always in the backyard. Didn't have much interest in them, though, growing up. They were kind of just there, you know, saw them, but that was dad's, you know, little trees. And then it wasn't until I was like 18, just almost my 18th birthday, couple of friends had gotten the Malsai Christmas gifts. In December, I'm a January birthday. Just had my birthday last week.
Ooh, so happy birthday. Belated birthday.
Yeah, thanks. Time flies when you're having fun. So my two really best friends got the Malsai Christmas gifts, and that spurred my interest. You know, my friends were doing it, so now it was cool. If my dad was doing it, it wasn't cool. And at 18, you kind of start, you know, looking into, at least I did, you know, looking into kind of like philosophy and world views and, you know, kind of expanding your awareness of what kind of world thought there was. So like a lot of time spent having like, you know, quasi philosophical discussions with my 18-year-old friends as we, you know, kind of waxed poetic and just kind of enjoyed those sorts of discussions, specifically like Asian philosophy. And so the bonsai kind of came in at a time where that was an interest. And being in Southern California in the late 90s, there still were a number of bonsai nurseries from the original kind of post-war practitioners. There was a local nursery in Huntington Beach that I would regularly go to just to look at trees because they were so cool. And then Southern California is one of the kind of, you know, but foundational communities of bonsai in the United States. And so there's a number of clubs. I was practicing martial arts at the time as well. And the Buddhist church that I studied at was where the Nampukai, the Orange County Bonsai Society, met regularly. And so I would go to their shows. And, you know, so it was just, I was just thankfully in a place that I had access to nurseries, which are, you know, fairly few and far between. I'm glad to hear that they still do exist and seems like they're kind of reemerging a little bit. And then just stuck with it as a hobby. It was nothing more to me than just kind of something that was cool. I've always loved plants and trees. It had a special place in my heart, and miniature things in general. Continued it through college. I was known as like the bonsai guy. I had a bonsai collection on the balcony of my fraternity house that I lived in through college. Though I wanted to pursue curation professionally, I got into exhibition design and curatorial work during college, and wanted to pursue that as a professional career. So I went to Washington, D.C., where I was a graduate student at the George Washington University's Museum Studies program. And so I wanted to basically be a curator of a small museum. That was my goal, specifically a cultural arts museum. My undergrad was in cultural anthropology. And so just understanding how other cultures think and work and their values and art and things like that was really fascinating. And so I was in DC for originally 2 years for my grad program, which is where the National Bonsai and Pinji Museum resides. So my very first day of being a resident of Washington, DC, I went to the museum in Northeast DC, and it was during the week, and I was walking through the John Naka North American Pavilion, and there was a guy there watering the trees. And I just kind of flippantly, you know, was like, oh, how do I get your job? You know, which I've heard people ask me that, or, you know, you're so lucky. I'm sure, Carmen, you've had similar experiences, you know? So I was that guy of like, oh, how do I get your job? And little did I know that within 2 years from saying that, I actually was there with that job of the assistant curator. The person I was speaking to, I found out later, was Michael James, who was the current curator. So we'd come back. He was working with Jack Sustick, who I know, Carmen, you have a relationship with now. So, you know, just in like the kind of, there's this lineage of bonsai professionals. You know, it's like, oh, my teacher was the student of, you know, this person who was the student of this one. You know, Carmen, you have the same thing now working with Michael, right? And that sort of like lineage of bonsai teachers. There's a lineage of curators as well. And so, Jack Sustick has a pretty wide reach in terms of his influence from, I'm sure, for myself. Chris Baker, who's at the Chicago Botanic Garden, got his start in D.C. And Carmen, I know you've been working with Jack for a number of years now. So we sort of share that curatorial family legacy as well. It's a specific person, I think, that is drawn towards curatorship of a bonsai collection. We can talk about some of the nuances about that, at least from my perspective. And I'm interested to hear Carmen's approach as well. Sorry, my alarm keeps going off. Long story short, I was in DC for 8 years as the assistant curator. And then in 2014, I saw they were advertising for the new curator of the Weyerhaeuser, you know, Pacific Rim collection that David DeGroat had single-handedly curated for over 25 years and built into this really prestigious public-private collection. They were spinning it off as a nonprofit, and had moved away from Weyerhaeuser, and they were looking for a curator to sort of take over creative direction and sort of be the face of this new kind of rebooted museum. And so the opportunity to move back to the West Coast, where I'm from, we just sort of found out we were having our second child. So it allowed us the opportunity to kind of make some moves in our family that we felt were beneficial for where we were at. Just the opportunity to take over kind of the helm of the museum, and the excitement of kind of the sort of the creative freedom that sort of was presented to me. Because I always had intended to be the curator of the national collection. That was my track. That was what everyone was sort of planning on, and I was planning on. I mean, you can't quite get much higher in the echelons of curatorship than being the curator of the national in DC. And so as far as I knew, that was where I was going to end up. But, you know, we never know what tomorrow is going to bring. So I just couldn't turn down the creative opportunities that sort of came with moving away from the federal government and into a nonprofit, organization. You know, a lot of pros and cons for each, but mm-hmm. just knowing kind of my ambitions for what I wanted to do from an exhibition standpoint, a creative, I just didn't see the potential of that happening in DC, unfortunately. And so I've been here now. I just passed my 10-year mark in October of last year. So I've been here for a decade now, which is hard to believe.
Yeah.
So there you go.
That's a really awesome background in it. Glad to hear all the little connections that they're really surprising to me, the connections they hear. All, like when you talk about Dave DeGroot, he was in New Orleans for a while, mm-hmm. and I got to meet him back when he was traveling a little bit after he left the Pacific Bonsai Museum and was just traveling around. It's awesome. And then,
he was a professional musician before he was a curator. You know, he played for the New Orleans Symphony as a percussionist. So it's a wide range of people that are drawn to curatorship, but I think there's definitely some consistencies in the personality types that are the skill sets that kind of gravitate towards this work more than maybe bonsai professional teachers, so to speak.
And I think it's really interesting too that you said being able to be more creative in your position there is, you know, that is what I think sets the Pacific Museum apart from the other ones that I've seen. Because obviously the one at the National, that has to be a certain way. It has a respect and a way that they represent those trees, of course. But but being where you're at, there's so much more freedom for expression, mm-hmm. which I think is so cool. You know, you guys get to pursue projects that you wouldn't otherwise see in a public collection. You know, like the labs thing that y'all, was that called labs that y'all did with Ryan?
The lab. And,
yeah. That stuff's just so interesting because mm-hmm. where else do you get to see that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Dave was pursuing those exhibits before you came on. So this was something that he had been doing for years before anyway.
Yeah. No, I mean, it really did work out. You know, when you're thinking of ideas, you think you're the first person to think about it, or you think you're so creative because you kind of came up with it. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, I mean, I knew of the Weyerhaeuser collection, and I knew of Dave and had read read his book and his articles. But, you know, when you are in your own collections, and I'm sure Carmen, you can speak to this, you become somewhat siloed just inevitably, right? You have so much that you're trying to focus on and execute that you can lose track of what other organizations are doing. And I feel like that's sort of something I'm trying to pull out of. I felt a little bit more disconnected from the bonsai community, and that's sort of grown over the years, which is why I'm trying to engage more like through podcasts like this. I feel that's a value to the museum and just to having me participate more so. But it is just sort of a natural thing. And so I wasn't fully aware of Dave's exhibitions, but he was pulling off, you know, multiple exhibitions a year, and specifically working with non-bonsai artists, you know, contemporary visual artists, mm-hmm. and bringing together that pairing of them. And that was something I was wanting to do, sort of not aware that he was doing it, but then kind of coming here, it felt so just natural as a continuation of that legacy that he kind of established. And yeah, I agree. I think every bonsai collection offers something different and plays a different role, or should at least, in the larger kind of community of bonsai in the United States. And, you know, the role of the PVM has really been to try to be the people that are like, what can we do that no one else could or would do, right? We're sort of trying to fill a space where it just maybe wouldn't be possible for other public collections, for a variety of reasons, to not be able to pursue some of these things that maybe be more, avant-garde or controversial isn't necessarily the right word, but just not, you know, there's more maybe challenges, or it's just not the priority, right? Every collection has its own priority. And so I thought it would be that, see, I felt there was a need for a public collection to be more of the trying to bridge the gap to contemporary audiences in a way that was more directly speaking to culture, with my anthropology background. Like, how do we make bonsai relevant to American culture today, other than only presenting it in the framework of a Japanese or an Asian sort of traditional cultural art, but adapting it like any art form has to adapt with the times? How do we make bonsai relevant to people today, other than being like, you have to, you know, study Japanese philosophy or understand gardening to such a high degree? You know, can you broaden this, the funnel for people to come into, at least to appreciate bonsai? And that's kind of been one of our mantras, is, you know, our goal isn't necessarily to create bonsai practitioners. We don't want, you know, it's great if you come here and are inspired to pick up bonsai as your own practice. But a lot of people go to museums to just be in, to appreciate artwork. So we say we want to create appreciators, not practitioners. So if you can appreciate bonsai, you can see the value of what we're doing. It not only has to be, you need to do bonsai, you know, we need more people doing bonsai. It's, we need more people appreciating it.
Mm-hmm. I use the Pacific Museum a lot in talks that I give or conversations I have with people at work, essentially people who aren't like deep in the bonsai community, as a way to, when I'm talking about like, what's the future of bonsai, or how do we move bonsai forward, or how do we make, like, where do we as like Americans take bonsai and make it our own? Because that's what we do with everything, right? We like take it and then we put our own spin on it. And so I've used a lot of the exhibitions, especially the visual art ones, the skateboards, and then the natives exhibition, to really kind of demonstrate to people, you know, a really well done way of doing something like that. Because there's a lot of ways people like can get real kitschy with it. And that's, sure, you know, fine too. But like, when you get like really into it with other kinds of artists and pulling these other people in, it really, I think, brings another level to bonsai. And that's one of the things I'm super excited about, like being back at the university, is how can I involve students and the university in like, okay, what can we do now with this collection? We've got all these people, all this creative energy, like, what are we going to do? So like, thank you. And thank Dave for all the work that you guys do have done out there, because it's, I think it's, it really stands out. And I think it leads the way for a lot of interpreting collections in a new way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, well, I'm really excited to see what you're going to work with, to have the resources of a university, because I think working with either grad students or undergraduate students or whatever capacity, you sort of find that, you know, to work with all of the, you know, it'd be so fun to approach. I think you could approach every department in a university and find some project that they could hypothetically participate in about the bonsai. I mean, it's
exactly,
that's sort of,
see,
where
I've said that before too. I'm like, I don't think there's any discipline here that like we couldn't connect to this collection somehow. So
exactly.
Like, I'm so excited that you see that too. Yay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would, like I said, you have that, that's be a great resource to have that access. And that, I guess, would make, to my knowledge, makes your collection, you stand out because of the access to a university, right? I'm not familiar, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know of many other, if any other, public collections that are associated with a major university than you guys.
I think actually there's another bonsai garden in Michigan at Hidden Lake Gardens, which is technically under Michigan State University, but Michigan State doesn't really, there's a big kind of disjointedness there of like Michigan State doesn't really interact much, but if they could, that would be cool.
Yeah. But I've never been to Mathai. You are on the campus of like,
we're like a little bit. So it's a weird setup. So we're like with the Arboretum and the Botanical Gardens, and the Arboretum is downtown right across from the hospital on Central Campus. And then the Botanical Gardens is like 4 miles kind of off the side of North Campus, kind of out of, it's like an old research facility that is also now a botanical garden. So we're a little bit out of the way, but we're close enough that a lot of people get to us, whether through university transit or, you know, their own cars. But so we're like kind of, we're on and off campus. It's, it would be nicer if we were central campus.
You have a relationship. Gotcha. Yeah. You're not directly on campus, but you have a, you at least have a relationship with the university, right? There's some active connection. I'm sure there are students either like either horticulture or biology or whatever, still engaging to some capacity. So, I mean, I would love to like, you know, get architecture students and engineering students. And I mean, obviously art students, but anyway, that's, I think that's a great role. You guys could kind of identify yourselves as how do you work with collegiate level students to really blow a lot of the doors open for even more ways to explore it. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got a museum studies program. So I may end up picking your brain at some point about how do we get these museum studies students? How do we integrate them? And how do we, like, I want to create that connection too with the university there. Like, okay, how do we,
How do you bridge that gap? And I think that was the thing we sort of started to talk into, Evan, you were sort of bringing up is, you know, the way that you handle your collection, interpret the collection, I think is important. And I think, at least in terms of our approach, you know, is kind of like how we're approaching how we engage with our visitors or the role we sort of are filling is relates to how we see our collection. And so because I sort of have the unique background of museum studies, you know, kind of that was my education, right, of collections management, exhibit design, visitor, you know, services, visitor interaction. I view the Bonsai Museum or the collection here in the same vein as like an art museum would view their collection. I view them as art objects first and bonsai second. It's like we have a collection like that requires a level of care to maintain, like any collection does, any art collection or museum does, natural history museum. We just, the care is much, much more demanding because the nature of bonsai, but ultimately using the trees more so as museum objects then opens up a broader kind of, I think, opportunity to see how you can utilize them other than just as bonsai in and of themselves. So you sort of are using them as the, you know, our current exhibition and sort of what I'm speaking to is, you know, trying to convey the aspects of bonsai horticulture and the aspects of their technical aspects like wiring and repotting and these sorts of things that people are obviously curious about. And, you know, you have to talk about them or you should talk about them because that's part of the appreciation of the effort that goes into caring for them is not like they just don't look like that all the time. Or, you know, I think people don't fully appreciate how much care goes into that. So to increase that appreciation, you have to tell them, but then also having it, how do you tell them in a way that's engaging and not maybe your standard, you know, like manners of like explaining it, like this is what photosynthesis is, or this is, you know, whatever, making it a little bit more engaging from a design standpoint where you are, you know, our exhibition Small Talk is we're sort of, the bonsai are sort of speaking in the first person. They're the ones that are actually answering the questions. So the exhibition is aimed more for like children and young families to come in and learn about bonsai, but not having it be this very kind of dry, either botanical language or this really kind of esoteric philosophical approach about the design, but more like, you know, this tree, you read the labeling and it's like the tree is speaking in the first person and has more of like a personality that you're kind of just like we were having a conversation, you know, asking the tree itself, like how often do you need to get watered? It's like, well, I need to get watered this many times because I'm a, you know, conifer or whatever. So just finding new ways to get people to engage is the challenge.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey guys, it's Evan with Underhill Bonsai, and I just wanted to tell you guys about Save Bonsai. It's going to be happening from March 28th to the 30th, 2025. We're going to be everything Louisiana for a full weekend, so we're going to include a crawfish boil, homemade gumbo, and other food trucks and vendors that are very special, I guess you can say, the southern culture of Louisiana. And also, the show will include a bonsai show with its own special awards, including Best in Show, Best Shohin, Best Traditional Design, People's Choice Award, and also a tongue-in-cheek Best Bald Cypress Bonsai Award. Guest artists and visiting artists will include Julian Tsai, Sylvia Smith, Mike Lane, Carmen Lesko-Bianski, Dawn Ketting, Randy Bennett, and Guy Guidry. Each artist will be presenting demonstrations and giving workshops throughout the weekend. You can go over to underhillbonsaistore.com and go under our Save Bonsai Workshops tab, and you can sign up for just regular attendance. It's going to be $25 just to get into the exhibit tent, and then all the workshops will be spaced out, and they will all have individual pricing. We hope to see you guys there.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
There's a lot to kind of chew on right there. I mean, you spit out a lot of the stuff that I was going to ask you, or we're going to get into. You're hitting all the points. So if I were to say, because I get that question every once in a while, like I'll meet someone down, like, you know, whatever, like a new friend or someone just by passing. We start talking about stuff that we do and we get into bonsai, and they ask me why bonsai. That's always been like one of the goofiest things for me to sit there. I say it's goofy because I'm like, just like, that's not easy to explain, but it's hard to explain to people how much bonsai relates to a lot of different aspects in our lives. Mm-hmm. And I would say this conversation here would be easier for me to direct them to this recording and then them to hear what you just said.
I find the same way. I'm like, go listen to them.
Yeah.
Let me quote this person for you.
Yeah. No, it's really, really cool to hear how relevant you want to make all of these trees. As like, I really appreciate that notion of make less practitioners, make more admirers, you know, because to be honest, like, whenever you guys set up, like put out those pins, the little enamel pins.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know those trees by name and I collect them.
Sure.
And I tell people and they ask me, and that stuff's really cool that we get to represent and know Damodo maple or Captain Hook. You know, that's really cool. I like how you guys bring the character out in the tree and it makes them more important, because there are lots and lots of Trident maples. There are lots and lots of Rocky Mountain juniper bonsai out there, but these are culturally and historically significant to our bonsai scene. And that's...
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
And you've expressed an interest in history, which I think, too, is... expressed an interest in the history, which I think, too, is a huge area of interest for me, because, again, part of being a curator is knowing your collection. It's not just the horticulture or the maintenance or the continuation of the care of the tree, but it's understanding who the person was that originally started the tree, what, you know, being able to speak to that, just as if you were an art history, you know, an art curator, you would know who these painters were, you would know their biography, you would know their approach to their work and what was going on in their life. And, you know, when I was in grad school, one of my aha moments where I was in a exhibition, and normally, you know, if you go to an art museum, they will, you know, you have the artwork and a lot of, you know, some of the interpretation or how we engage with art can be more passive in that, you know, art is presented and then the audience or the viewer is sort of then obligated to attempt to work through and understand the work on their own, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think there's value to try to for people to engage with, like, can you figure out what's happening or why the art is making you feel what you're feeling or whatever, right? Some level of self, like critical thinking, right? But I think one of the really cool experiences was when I went to it was the Women's Art Museum in DC. We were going through an exhibition of early painters, and it was explaining kind of what was happening in this artist's life and how it connected to the you know, sort of the women's suffrage movement at the time. Mm-hmm. And sort of then seeing, knowing that backstory gave me such a deeper appreciation and connection to that painting. It was a beautiful work, right? On sort of the face value of it, I could appreciate it just as a execution of technique and design and art. But once you added these layers of depth to understanding who the person was and what was happening to them in their life, now all of a sudden it made it so much more interesting and engaging and connecting. And one of the things that's sort of, when you talked about, we talked about, you know, interpreting bonsai, you know, I think, or interpreting art in general, you know, I think of curators as the sort of like, as cultural interpreters, as sort of, they are the ones that are helping you understand what the meaning is. Because, you know, when I go to Japan, I don't speak Japanese, so I need an interpreter. I need someone to help me understand the language so that I can better communicate. Because, I mean, ultimately, art is about communication, right? And so If someone can help me understand what I'm seeing or what I'm hearing better, then that just sort of makes me able to, you know, understand and connect faster. So curators serve that role of helping the public understand what they're seeing in a way that allows them to have a deeper appreciation. And so you can go to a museum and kind of like have your own unique experience and bring your own perspective. And then also, I think too, reading the labels or reading the catalog or doing a little bit of more background understanding will give you that kind of fuller, richer picture. And so it's exciting, the history, kind of like what we're talking about, to know like who Von Banting was, or who Guy Guidry was, or who Dave DeGroat was, or who these people were and where they come from, helps to influence not just how you're presenting your work, but also the continuation of the maintenance of the collection. Because one of the interesting things, you know, with bonsai is that because it's this living art form and we're influencing the tree, it's impossible for me to not add something of my own aesthetic or my own personality to the trees that I'm engaging with. But You're also, as a curator, much like an art conservator, trying to minimize how much of yourself you're doing it. Because, you know, for a painting conservator, they'll study the brush strokes that the artist used, and when they're restoring a painting, they're going to try to imitate the same brush stroke pattern so that their repair is non-noticeable, right? And it's the same with the bonsai. You have to understand the, you know, the style of Von Banting or the style of Guy Guidry or style of John Naka to try to imitate that style in a way that's at least close enough to where the tree is not somehow deviating too much from maybe their stylistic approach, which is going to be different from my own. But then also knowing where you might have to infuse your own style to maybe continue to advance the tree in a way that's going to continue to add value to it. So it's this really interesting balancing act of how much do you put your own stamp on things versus how much are you trying to continue to refine and mature something in as much as you can, the same style or effort or, you know, sort of spirit of the original person. Yeah.
That's one of the things that, one of the questions that's been maybe haunting isn't quite the right word, but I've been having
daunting.
These discussions.
Mm-hmm.
Daunting. Yeah.
Yeah.
That I've been having, it's this question I've been having these conversations about since I've been back at the university with the collection. And, you know, a lot of our original collection are from local hobbyists, you know, who just donated trees to the collection. And how much do we want to change to get the tree up to the best tree it can be versus how much do we want to preserve the original intention of the artist, and it's a very complicated question and process to work through. And we haven't quite come to a decision yet as to where. Mm-hmm. I haven't quite talked to enough people yet to figure out what exactly it is we're doing. But I think a lot of it right now is, you know, improving the tree the best we can without making drastic changes to the tree, unless necessary for whatever health reason. But it's so tricky to, because especially, you know, just coming out of an apprenticeship and having all this with a lot of these trees that were just raw stock, and just, you know, having Michael say, do the tree, you know, design the tree. It's like, I see these trees and I'm like, oh, I could do this, I could do this. It's like, hold on, like, maybe step back. And I think I just need to buy myself some more trees.
Yeah.
Get that out of my system elsewhere.
That's a great point. I mean, because, you know, even in Japan, there is a reverence to trees, especially like the Kichoi bonsai that are like well-known. And then, you know, there's the, is there some sort of change that's made purely to showcase the technique of the artist, or, you know, so I guess
for me, I really have to make sure that ego is not guiding that decision, right?
I don't want to show what's my motivation, right? And I think ultimately every curator is going to have to, you know, if you can sort of sleep at night with those decisions, I think you're okay. Now, obviously everyone's going to have their own level of comfort. But I think it depends on what's your intent. If my intent is to like show off how amazing I am and change a John Naka tree because, you know, I'm going to do it better, or I want to change it for whatever, that's obviously not the right starting point.
Right.
But I also think too, there's a level that a tree gets, much like artwork, it becomes iconic, right? Ghostin in DC, or the Demoto tree here, or, you know, whatever. There's a level that a tree has retained where you expect it to look a certain way. And, you know, the challenge with bonsai is that they don't stay the same. So, you know, I sort of describe it as like, we're trying, like, if you see a photo of yourself from a child through your adolescence, through adulthood to, you know, old age, you are going to look different, right? But it's still going to look like you.
Mm-hmm.
You just like it, you can still see your smile or your eyes or your character, but you're wearing different clothes. You're maturing, right? And so there's maybe a potential disservice to keeping a bonsai looking like it was a teenager forever and ever and ever. That becomes a little, you know, uncomfortable. And also like the idea of like, well, what would John Naka be doing if he was still alive, right? He wouldn't be keeping this tree exactly how it looked in 1994. Like,
right.
You know, so that's sort of, we're trying to understand it and do your research and do your kind of due diligence. And also then not making those major decisions, which shouldn't be very frequent, but also giving enough time. So there are trees that I have changed. I do try to change, if I do change something dramatically, like switching the front, for example, I do try to take an art conservator approach to where everything that art conservator does is undoable. Like if better techniques emerge, or if, you know, a better way of doing it, you can remove their paint that they applied. It's not a forever thing. Obviously it's not always the case with bonsai, but in general, if the next curator comes along and is like, yeah, Aaron totally messed this up, I'm going to switch the front, it's not been changed so much that could not happen, right? It's maybe just a different presentation. And sometimes things do happen that you have to respond to. But anyway, what I'm trying to just get at is like, there's kind of a level that a tree attains that it merits us less of that consideration. And then there's trees that are maybe from a local hobbyist who wasn't, you know, John Naka, or who wasn't, Von Bantin, you know, and the tree would be better off if there was a level of change what requires cutting off every branch and regrowing it out. Like that's valid, right? And so you kind of have to weigh the cultural significance of that work, you know, and how much people will actually notice the change. If, you know, if no one notices the change, well, then it's probably going to be okay. Whereas if you did something dramatic and everyone's going to notice it. And I think that's why it's one of the more challenging things in DC, is because the trees there are so well known, are so iconic, that any changes become much more scrutinized
and you have more eyes look at it.
One about being in DM is there is a little, not to say we don't have iconic trees, but there's a little bit less, you know, oversight or a little less scrutiny, which allows you to have a little bit more freedom in that. And I think Dave also actively worked to continually improve the trees as much as he could. He didn't try to limit himself from making changes he felt were in the best interest of the tree, right? But yeah, it's not a quick decision. And at the end of the day, if you can justify it, I think you have to be able to explain very clearly why you made those changes and why you think they're better. People can agree or disagree, but you at least have to be able to justify it.
Mm-hmm.
At least within yourself, right? That I'm doing what I consider to be the best for this tree that is not sort of fulfilling some ego driven, motivation, right? Mm-hmm.
And that makes me think of like you said, making improvements where you would see fit, honoring the tree's history, the person who worked on it before. And I think one of the really cool things that you guys are working on now is working with Nal Tokatake and designing pots for trees. I think that's so beautiful.
We're super fortunate to have Nal close by in Portland, and his skill set is unbelievable. So we have a really great arrangement where he is making us one new container a year for a tree.
That's so
cool. We have it as part of our repot and reconnect event where we sort of repot that tree in that container. And so trying to draw upon the sort of iconic, because there's a pairing that these trees have with the pot. It becomes part of that composition. But also the trees will grow out of those pots. And so a lot of the trees after 30 years, they do need a slightly larger container. They've outgrown it, right? And that's kind of speaking to this this idea of how do you still continue the spirit of the tree, but it's no longer, you can't keep it in that pot forever, right? So drawing upon maybe the original or the pot that it was known to be in, pulling some details, either it's a similar color, within the color spectrum or the shape or whatever, to evoke that kind of nod to the past, but also, giving it its new container for maybe the next 30 years. We're really excited to be working with Nal and what he's created for the two pots we have so far are amazing.
Yeah. And my God, the North American bonsai pottery scene is getting so good. There's so many great potters that I've met, recently, and of course I deal with a lot of pottery through my nursery. I do a lot of sales for imported stuff such as the Japanese, Chinese, Taiwan, all the other types of pottery that we would get. But we're extremely fortunate here in the States to have people who do really good work, and now is top notch. I have to say I'm fortunate to own two of his containers. The ones I do own, I'm very covenant of. I love having them. Also his wife, May, is her name correct?
Mary,
sorry. Mm-hmm. I think on her Instagram, I think I read it as May. But yeah, Mary, she does the painting on the pots, and they're just so good. Mm-hmm. They're just such a treasure to have here, working and making this pottery. Shout out to Nal. We've mentioned him and his wife a few times, but you have to go to him and talk to him to obtain his pottery. I learned that, but it's totally worth it. I was able to meet Nal at the Bonsai Central show last year. He's a really nice guy. But yeah, that's really cool that we get to hear. And that was one of my big topics I wanted to actually pass by you, Aaron, and you just went straight for it. You went into it naturally. So your brain is in the right place for it, is respecting old trees, respecting the creator, respecting the decisions that are made on these trees, because we want these trees to outlast us and you as a curator and so on. And, you know, and paying attention to nuances like, oh, this tree has been in this pot for 30 years. And a lot of people ask me, it's a really funny thing. I love hearing that is some people ask me, like, how long does this tree stay in this pot for? They're like, it's going to get big one day. Because they, like, I work with a lot of trees that are, you know, big trees, you know, bald cypress, hackberry, hornbeam, and et cetera. And they do grow into big trees. And people are like, it's going to get really big one day. I'm like, well, it might go up slightly. Like, I might put like a quarter inch on all sides. And they're like, that's not exciting. They don't want to hear that. But, you know, but that's really cool to know that we're able to keep these trees happy and also bring them forward and modernize them as well. With, I mean, with stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. And when it's appropriate, right? So I think one of the examples that, you know, I'm assuming you've seen we've talked about the Von Banting cypress before we started,
yep.
You know, that was in this very distinct kind of aqua blue oval container. And if you look at any photo of that tree for the last 30 plus years, it was in that container. Right? And it's, mm-hmm. it becomes almost that just like that distinctive, that is the pot, that is its container. And so it doesn't hurt to look and assess, like, is there a better container for it? But ultimately, like, there are trees that are so married to their container because they've been in it for, you know, a very, very long time. But the container for that now made, you know, we talked about referencing it, referencing the kind of softer oval form. But he also made it slightly, you know, more of a lotus shape. And he made three different versions of it, each with a different glaze, you know, mm-hmm. from its kind of aqua blue that it had and maybe a little darker blue, because obviously the bald cypress and water goes hand in hand and kind of yep. evoked that. But we ended up landing on this darker green, almost like, you know, very dark, boggy swamp, you know, where obviously we think of blue as, you know, the swamp is water, but it's not this bright blue. If you go into the bayou, it's a dark, muddy green, you know, there's like rusty orange and
I might
algae
know about
floating
that.
In it. Yeah, I think you do.
Yeah.
So anyway, it just was kind of that ability to do a nod to the original one in a way, but still change it enough to where it feels like it's a different tree a little bit in a good way. And so the next tree that he's making a container for is our Sequoia, our Coast Redwood.
Yep.
Which is another really famous tree of ours, one of our fan favorites. But that one, we're keeping it kind of really consistent with its form, right? It needed it to be slightly deeper. I didn't quite have the right size for, you know, as we all know. So to get to create one to the spec that we were needing it, and still though, trying to maintain that more of a traditional, I wouldn't say a copy of it, but pretty darn close to, we're just sort of making a slight variation to the traditional one that it had been in, right? And so, you know, it doesn't mean just because you make a new pot, you're going to suddenly go very different. You know, it's considering the formal upright as being more of a traditional form, that coming from a Japanese American family, the Domotos, and, you know, the tie to Japan, you know, those sorts of things are all sort of are weighing into that decision making of, you know, trying to still continue to revere or reverence the history of the tree through the container, even when you're making a new one, right?
Yeah. I mean, the one with the cypress, that one really spoke to, like, my heart, my bonsai heart, the way that Mao approached it, and he put the pelicans on there.
Yeah.
And by the way, you mentioned that earlier, and, you know, I love history and all, and I actually ended up obtaining the blue one.
Oh, nice.
So that's
what you got.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I have a tree in it. So yeah. I'll have to send you a picture.
Is that the
later
one that
on.
Has kind of the heavier glaze? There's like some dripping going
yep.
on. Is that?
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. That one. Yep. It was tough. I mean, so what we did for our event, we had all three of them and we put the tree in all three of those pots. So your pot, you know, it did have the Von Banting tree
sit
in
point.
It for a few minutes as we were, you know, it shook the hand that of the tree, so to speak. And so we did have a fun opportunity to kind of, everyone got to, you know, the group got to see what it did look like. And we got to have somewhat of a discussion of what each one offered to it. And there were a lot of people who were opting for that blue one. because it's gorgeous and it does much more strongly reference the kind of original pot. But seeing the green one with the orange, and it just felt like it was a kind of a way to get a new, you know, a slightly new expression of that tree at this point.
Yeah, that's something.
Well,
that
glad to hear you have it.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, I'll send you a picture later on and I'll tell you the significance of the tree that I put in mine, but that's not, but you know, it's not important to this conversation. We'll, but there's something they bring up about the pottery aspect. This is something I hammer on when people are coming to learn from me. We learn how to make trees from stock a lot here because we have to grow a lot of our trees. They grow really fast. Because we grow a lot of stuff like trident maples and cedar elms and et cetera. Things that I can put in the ground for a couple of years and they can just grow really quick. And then we get to this point where we have to select a container. And I feel like selecting a bonsai pot for a tree is one of the most challenging aspects. It's very hard to teach that. And there's so many pots out there. And you're always like, if only I had this pot was this depth and it was this color, and that's where we're fortunate is that there's a lot of amazing bonsai potters in the United States that you can call them up and tell them, I need this pot made this way. I would like these glazes. Ask them what glazes they are comfortable with and that they have had success with. For instance, I work with Byron Myrick a lot in out of Mississippi, and he can make just about anything. When it comes to specifics and specifications of what it should be. Whereas Now's approach is going to be very traditional. That's what I love about Now's stuff is like, I love me a hand-thrown, hand-built pot, but then Now's pots, they're made into, he makes these wooden forms and everything's exact and like made the way it should be. And he can make that over and over as he needs. There's also a very big thing to be said there with that type of approach too. And then when you guys get to make multiple copies of that pot with different glazes, and then you get to slot the trees in and out, that's something that people don't get to see. And so hats off to you guys coming up with that project. That's really cool. And it further elevates our experience of how we should view trees. So,
well, and I'm going to give credit to Now because he was the one that he decided to make the tree pot. He's like, I made three of them. I'm like, oh, okay. Like,
oh,
nice. Yeah. Like, you know,
I can picture him saying that too.
Yeah. He's like, I made three of them. I'm like, yeah, awesome. Like let's, then that opened up the window to do that. Right. So, and then what's another really cool thing is like some of the pots that Ron Lang made for our lab project that we didn't use then went out into the community and they're being used in other compositions. And so to hear like, you know, again, that pot came out of a specific commission for the museum, but then we don't need all of them. So then to go out, right, there is that kind of
that's great,
that connection that kind of again spurs a, and I think that's kind of what speaking to these projects does from what we can do as a museum. And you know, Carmen, you know, I would encourage you guys in every public collection to try to encourage potters or artists or whatever to be more creative in that by supporting them. So like, you know, by having this opportunity for Now to say, hey, Now, can you make us a pot or three or whatever, it allows that person then the opportunity to do it when otherwise they might just be making things that they know they can sell because that's, you know, they have to, right? So same thing with you, Evan, like, you know, if you were sort of just given a blank check more or less, be like, oh, Evan, like, go make us something really cool. Like, you know, we might not use all of it, but then you're sort of encouraging that creativity, and then it kind of ripples out a little bit into the community. Other people get the benefit of that even secondhand with getting what was not used primarily. So yeah, I think that's one of the roles that public collections can really play is sort of fostering that kind of you know, artist in residency or projects that kind of allow for potters or artists, whoever, to really be challenged to grow their own skill set, because that's going to benefit everybody else because they're going to continue to level up. So so yeah, I see that's kind of another one of our unique things we try to do, at least and where we can, for sure.
Yeah, the whole thing kind of comes back around, and in my mind is like representing all the different arts. We had talked about this a little bit earlier. So you get pottery. I mean, because the tree is married to the pot. So that's got to be first and foremost, that's got to be right. It's got to be the right size and depth for the tree, make it happy, et cetera, et cetera. And then we get to play around a lot, which is a really cool thing that you guys do it at y'all's collection, is that you don't just see the traditional scrolls behind the tree. Like was mentioned earlier, it's like the skateboards. That was, that's really cool. And then you guys did the natives thing where y'all encouraged painters and mixed media artists to come in and do something that liberated them for a certain tree. They were like, oh, well, if this tree had this, and you give them that freedom, and you'll be surprised. Like you said, you'll be surprised what people will run with and have like no holds, you know, like artists. That's one of the biggest things with being an artist in, you know, any place in the world from different walks of life is limitations. And so, taking off those guards and saying, what do you see? And letting them create something, a stand, a painting, an accent to that tree. Another thing that I see you guys do every once in a while, and I tell my wife this, it's really funny because you guys, some of the stuff y'all post on social media, whenever people come in and y'all have people paint the trees or draw them or sketch them, I tell my wife, because she used to do painting in college and she's not bad at it, I'm like, look what you could do for me. You know, I've always wanted a couple people have drawn my trees, and it's such a sweet, sentimental kind of feeling to that. It's like, I created this and now it's art speaking art. You know what I mean? Like it brings it to that next level. It's really nice.
You make
nice.
Art of art.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just what it is, right? You're influencing. The more opportunities you're providing for creative people to create something that you're having some, you know, I think I agree. You're freeing them to do it by also giving them some guidance at the same time, and then kind of trusting them to kind of go wild. It really creates things that you could never have thought of. And you're like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. I've always just been so pleasantly surprised whenever we've engaged with specifically like non-bonsai artists. And, you know, there's challenges to try to like make sure you're communicating the minimal needs of something. But for me personally, like that's what I really, if I could just work with, you know, sculptors or digital designers or basically anyone who's got an arts background that's not from the bonsai sphere, and trying to find ways to integrate the two, like that's for me is just like, that's where I want to be all the time. And so kind of like our avant-garde exhibition we did last year or 2 years ago? That was kind of an effort to kind of showcase things like what Michael has done with his stands and display, and just trying to, you know, put a little bit of a finger on the pulse of where is that boundary. And I think, you know, you sort of spoke to the role of the container in bonsai. And I think that is, you know, that's sort of the relationship of the pot to the container is definitive to bonsai, right? Like bonsai is tree in a container. And so I don't know if we ever will be able to get away from the needing to have a container in this art form, because that's kind of by definition what it is. Yeah. But one of the things that I'm just really interested in kind of exploring on a personal level and sort of curatorially is like, how do we move, how do we have more ability to play with the container in a quicker way, right? Because it is this, it is, a lot of it is talked about like a marriage, right? It's like, this is it, like, you know, 30 years, baby, like the word committing, and kind of talked about like that, right? Like there's a lot of pressure of like, I got to get the right one. And we know, like, we do, trees will change containers, especially earlier on in their life as they're growing and refining. But eventually they get to a stage, you know, when they do probably enter a public collection where their root ball is really established, they're not growing a whole lot. And that container relationship does become this very significant component of it. And one of the things that I've seen as we kind of continue to play with the container is how much it changes the context of the tree, the feeling of the tree, right? We kind of talked about the interpretation of it. And that's really the only way, at least one of the major ways, that you can explore how to present bonsai in different aesthetic context, is because it's a tree. We can't change the tree that dramatically as rapidly. But if there was a way to figure out to at least change the exterior of the container or the visual of the container while not having to fully repot it, like that's sort of where I'm really interested in. It almost like you're changing your clothes in that graphic. Like, could you just quickly change the exterior of a container and develop some sort of system that you're just maybe, you know, you have your sort of fixed, you know, root container that's in either a oval or a rectangle or whatever, and that you could just more or less just, you know, almost like you have like a Doban or something that you could set it inside of a container and make it look like it's not just, you know, stuck in there, but somehow, you know, rapidly changing the texture or color or something that would allow you to just, oh, I want to see it in this, and oh, tomorrow I want to see it in that. It feels a little bit more fun to try to figure out how you could do that in some way. I don't know, but I've got some ideas, but that's kind of something I'm wanting to explore a little bit more here. How to play with that container faster. Change it quicker.
Sounds
once
like
every decade.
Like something that maybe if there's any aspiring bonsai potters that are listening to this right now, if you've got any ideas, reach out to us. That sounds like a job for them.
It reminds me of this commercial I saw growing up, like when I was a teenager or whatever, of this, like, as seen on TV, it was like this purse and it had like a magnetic cover, and you would like just change the cover to your outfit, to your mood, whatever. We just need that for bonsai pot.
Yeah,
let's do it.
I mean, that's kind of where I'm headed, is something with magnetic. Something magnetic is kind of what I'm working on at the moment, actually. So we'll see how it comes out. But
I mean, Oh, go ahead, Carmen. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to change topic. So
No, that's fine.
Oh. I just had a quick question. Well, not really a quick question, but so do you have long involved question of, do you have your own collection, and what does that look like compared with the collection?
That's a great question. I mean, I tend to always say, like, it's an obvious answer, but curators, in my experience, either have like no trees or they have like a huge private collection. I mean, obviously it's one or the other, but I tend to have very few of my own trees. I have a handful of sentimental trees, but I do not have a 40 to 60 tree personal collection. I think a lot of that I downsized when we moved. We had a third of an acre in Maryland, a three-story home, and we sold all of that and just kind of downsized so that my wife didn't have to work to take care of our kids. So anyway, so I got rid of a lot of stuff when I moved to the West Coast. And then, you know, it is something when you do something professionally, just, at least for me, I tend to want to do something else in my spare time.
Yeah.
And I think that also rapidly changed when I became a father 14 years ago. You know, if I am at home, I just want to be more present for my kids, not being like, oh, I've got to go water. And so it just didn't quite fit. And so like I said, I've got a couple, but thankfully I really get to stretch my kind of like creative bonsai wings here enough to where I don't feel I need my own personal collection to kind of execute that individual ideas, right? That's, again, like, that's, I'm so fortunate to be in that position, because not all curators get to do that. Or they are just so bonsai, you know, crazy, I guess, to have a public collection they're maintaining and a private collection. I'm like, more power to you, man. I totally respect, respect that. And I understand that, but that's just not me. So no, I don't have a sizable personal collection beyond just like half a dozen very sentimental trees. Yeah.
How about you,
Carmen? You have a collection? Are you aspiring to develop one, or kind of how do you feel about that?
Kind of similar. I have the squirrels just took care of a lot of the really young trees that I had on my back porch. But luckily those were all the important stuff I overwintering elsewhere. So a couple of the saplings
just
got chewed on. We had a really, really cold week, and I think they got really excited about the bark. So we'll see.
Yeah.
I should know better, but I've got probably about under 10 trees. Most of them are like projects in progress that are, you know, something I'm developing just so I have some kind of personal portfolio.
Yeah.
I think four of them are still in Portland, so I'm going to have to, but I wasn't able to move them when I moved, so I've got to go back and get them. So if you're driving to the East Coast anytime soon, let me know and I'll pay you to transport them. Anyway, so I'm hoping to have a small collection of my own just to kind of play around with some wacky ideas I've, you know, come up with over time. But mostly, again, you know, being a parent, like you said, it's you get home and there's only so much time. And I spent 3 years, you know, living on site where I, you know, 24/7 responsibility for trees. So being able to kind of walk away from it is really nice. But then I have found on the weekend, sometimes I'm like, man, I could really go for like some wiring or something and then like not had anything. So I'm trying to, I think, figure out the balance of how much I'm going to have that's mine. And we're in a condo right now, so like I don't have a ton of space and, you know, but I'll probably have a small collection of my own once we're really settled. But yeah, mostly I can scratch the itch at work. So
Yeah. It's
and,
always,
and through traveling, I'm trying to do some traveling and teaching and stuff so I can get some of that out too.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, we'll see how your collection progresses over the years. So,
yeah.
And so real quick for you on, before we get to the end of our episode here, it's a good note to end on is personal trees and stuff. I know that this kind of, it's kind of a sucky question to ask some people because it's not always the case. Do you still have your first tree or one of your first trees?
Yeah, I wish I did. So I was in DC and I had left my collection at my parents' house and I would always come whenever I came back home. My very first thing I would do is I'd go check the trees and they were on an auto irrigation system. And my dad was, you know, good enough to kind of take care of them while I was in grad school. And then, you know, the one time I did not check when I first got back from the East Coast and the system had like failed the day before and I didn't check them for like 3 days. And so, no, unfortunately I don't. And then I did have a number of original trees still that was my first one. And then a couple other, a nor'easter in DC, Maryland, you know, a late winter. Yeah, it was March, so it should have been warm, and I got all excited and got them outside. And then there was one of those northeaster winter things that just freeze dried. Like I had this really nice sweet liquid amber orientalis, like a grown, like what it was one of my first trees that I got from Southern California. This little stick, and it was like 15 years, and it was really nice developing and just croaked. So that's another thing is it gets a little sad to be like losing your own trees over time. But I still have, so the two trees I do have are very special to me. I have the juniper that was my interview demo tree for the national assistant curator position.
There you go.
Or no, I should say, no, it wasn't that. This was my first, this was actually my first demo tree I did as the assistant curator. That's what it was.
Okay.
My very first demo I did at the national for my, you know, Saturday, whatever. And my wife, who I just had met, who wasn't my wife at the time, came to that, my very first public demo with her girlfriend. I just met her and they came to watch me do that. So I sell that tree. And then I was in the Joshua Roth New Talent Contest a long time ago. And I still have that tree that I styled for that.
Nice.
So those two are nice and that's enough. I got a couple sentimental trees, but, I've lost my first one, very sad, and my second and my third and my fourth and my fifth. But thankfully, you know, very few collection trees have been lost. Those are the ones you just don't ever want to have to. So I'd rather have lost my own than anything I've ever had to take care of in a public setting. So that's tough.
It's
about you guys? Do you guys have your first tree still or?
I think, the first thing I ever got was like a juniper seedling, you know, like it died. It was so fast. I didn't have any I had zero experience. I had like one day experience. Like it just died.
It was instantaneous.
And then, like my first tree, I don't even know what I would consider. I've lost a lot of the little stuff that like I started with just as side projects. I didn't care very much about. So as it has perished from my lack of care, it hasn't been too sad. I do have, there's one azalea that I purchased in Japan in 2019. That was probably when I like really like was hooked like 100% into bonsai. I have that tree still, and it's coming along nicely, but it's not my first one, but it's one of the first ones I cared about.
For me, I don't have the first road molsai, I guess you can say, that I acquired, which is funny. I was going to mention it. I've only met one person so far that has like gone into doing bonsai for a long time and then was like, where's your first tree? And it's Michael Hagedorn has that juniper. Mm-hmm. And he still has that same tree. That's incredible to me. Cause that's one of the things I always think about is like, what do these people, I always like asking people, do you have your first tree? And mine would have theoretically been that roadside, but of course we don't know what we're doing. There was no way that that thing was going to survive anyway, inside my window in my kitchen. But you know, later on I did acquire a handful of crepe myrtles from a local landscape nursery, and I guess you can say that's whenever the bug really bit me and I was like, I'm gonna take up a bunch of early trees, like raw stock, and I'm gonna work them into something. And I do have one crepe myrtle from that the early days still that's in my collection. And I call it my ugliest favorite tree because it's this big, giant, gnarly, old, the roots are bad. The roots are twisted and they're on top of each other and crossing. And then it took me a long time to get to that point where I was comfortable with that tree to say, it feels and looks like a bonsai, you know? And so, yeah, I kind of have one, but I would say that was, you know, and I'm super... I reference back to earlier episodes, if listeners are familiar, people know that I'm very into native plants, and it's one of the trees that I allow to be in my collection because I rather have Louisiana or Southeast native trees in my collection, honestly. But yeah, that's one of the few early ones I still have. So yeah, it's a really interesting thing to think about, you know?
Yeah, I wish I still had it, but oh well, you know.
Exactly.
But what are you gonna do? Doesn't always work out. Learn from it, move on.
Yeah, because we have to get better at bonsai. We have to progress. I mean, the trees.
And that's the what John Naka said was the secret of bonsai is that you have to kill some trees. So
yeah, he had a lot of good sayings. that you know, killing trees to learn. And you know, that's just a closing to kind of close us out here. I'll say this is like. You know, I have people who come in here, want to start bonsai and they want to do bonsai, gets really serious and start taking on a lot of plants. And they're always like, what tree should I buy? And I always tell them, buy as many as you can within your budget and don't buy one that you're going to spend a lot of money on because you will kill that one. So, yeah, just a little sentiment there. Anyway. So yeah, thanks so much for hanging out with us, Aaron. This is
likewise.
It's a real pleasure to have guests on our show, and I'm gonna be honest, I was very excited, looking forward to talking to you because, like I said, very big fan of the collection out there. Just to also to add some sentiment to it, me and my wife, we went out to Portland. To visit, and we stayed in Tacoma, and we eventually went to Portland Japanese Garden, and one of my destinations was to end up at the Pacific Bonsai Museum to go see you guys, and that was the same trip that I asked my wife Caitlin to marry me. So it holds a special place for me as well, because we got to experience that on the high of that trip. I was like, hell yeah, really cool bonsai. The collection was, you know, but y'all were winterized at that time. I went there in December. But anyway,
But yeah,
that's funny, because when I went to see that collection, I had also a very sentimental moment where I got to see this statue called Crow with French Fries. And
oh, yes, yes, yes. Uh-huh. I know where that one is. Yeah.
That's like a really cool stone and statue.
It's the best piece of art I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up.
Well, outside of Bonsai. Yeah. I'll send you a picture.
It's on your way to Mount Rainier. On your way to the Mount Rainier, you pass it.
It's great.
Yeah. Crow with French Fries is the name of the piece. Yeah. That's awesome.
Giant crow. Mm-hmm. It's a big sculpture.
It's amazing.
That's excellent. But anyway, yeah, like I said, it's a pleasure to have guests on. Thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Thank you so much, too. Yeah, I appreciate the offer and appreciate you guys taking the time. And excited to hear, you know, what we do is people appreciate what we do, because that's, you know, ultimately what our goal is for more appreciators. And so I'm really excited to, Carmen, that you're back in Michigan, and excited to see what you and Jack are up to out there. And Evan, please come back to the Pacific Northwest, and hopefully we can connect when you're out here again.
Yeah, for sure, man, for sure. And we always do like a little shout out and things coming in the future for people when they're on with us. So you want to tell people where to check out the Pacific Bonsai Museum and some of the events coming up.
Yeah. So our website, PacificBonsaiMuseum.org, our Instagram handle, Pacific Bonsai Museum. And then we are really excited to be opening our new exhibition called Building Wonder, the Bonsai Treehouses of Dave Creek. And so this gentleman was the lead character designer for the animated sitcom Bob's Burgers, who unfortunately passed away in 2021.
Wow.
And his pastime, being a full-time artist, was to make these miniature tree houses inside dead bonsai. And his family created a foundation in his honor to showcase these trees to like museums, libraries, children's hospitals, just to kind of continue his spirit of kind of just pursuing life passionately and following your dreams. And these things are really spectacular. So they're getting created up in LA and making their way up to here this weekend. And the show will be running all year long. It's opening up on February 11th. I actually have one right next to me. If you can see it here. We got this one from a local person who bought this one. But
oh my gosh.
Just super intricate, amazing, and you kind of want to like live in them. He basically custom built these little tree houses. So people are in the area, be sure to come by this year to see these this really special exhibition. It's the first time they're going to be kind of on public view. They've been in the Children's Hospital and Los Shriners Children's Hospital in LA for the last year, which obviously isn't too open to public to just come in and out. So we're really excited to see kind of what the public response is going to be to come and see these trees for the first time. So yeah, Building Wonder opening February 11th and running
how long does it run? When does it close?
It runs all year. So it's going to close, I would say, mid, late December. I don't have the exact date on my head, off my head. So we typically close the museum right before Christmas for the last sort of week and a half we go dark. So it'll be up through the majority of December, probably closing sometime around the 20th or 21st, somewhere there. But
cool.
It'll be on our website too if you have any questions, back dates. But
cool.
Yeah, I'm coming out here in December or
End of November. So I'll try to swing by and see it.
If you guys want to check out more about me, specifically Evan Pardew or Underhill, you can go to underhill.com, and you can go look at articles that I wrote, and you can go to Underhill on YouTube and you can see our channel where I work on trees and I do demonstrations on there. We are doing monthly uploads. I'm really happy to say that we are being very consistent. So I'm going into repotting season and there's some really exciting stuff that we're going to be posting for this month. And then of course you can follow us on Instagram. You can follow Little Things for Bonsai People on Instagram as well. And then for Carmen, where do they check out your stuff?
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Becoming Bonsai, and be sure to check out the Purple Pot Society, the National Women's Bonsai Group, which works to inspire and encourage women to do more bonsai.
Yep. And it's not you don't have to be a woman to support. I'm a member of the Purple Pot Society, so support women in bonsai, please.
Woo.
Yep. Cool. So you guys have a great week, and our listeners have a great week. We can't wait to see what's going to happen next episode. It's always a surprise, it feels like. So thanks, Aaron, for hanging out.
Thanks, Aaron. Good to see you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Feel better. Thanks for hanging out.
Thank you.
All right.